This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. The days have gotten colder and the holidays are just around the corner. For many of us, that's a recipe for a perfect movie night to watch some classic film trilogies. But what makes a great movie trilogy? Film critic T.T. Sternenzi has written about his top 10 trilogies in a column on our website, WVXU.org. He joins me now to talk about which trilogies have endured the test of time and continue to entertain us. Welcome back, T.T.
Thank you for having me.
It's always fun to have you here. Many of us are going to have some time off later this week for Thanksgiving. Does that make the holidays a good time to binge watch some of these trilogies?
I would love to think so. I, unfortunately, as a critic, don't usually have the time to do it. But if I ever get that chance, it's always at the top of my list.
You're too busy watching all the new stuff coming out,
right?
Huh? You have these 10 top trilogies on your list. Is there something all of these picks have in common?
Probably not one thing in particular, but I think overall there is an overarching kind of process behind it all. I think filmmakers understand when they're telling stories, you know, even if you don't start with the whole blueprint there in place, you know when you've got a really great start and you think that there are ways and places that you want to continue to go, characters that you want to explore more, situations that can spin out of this. And you're like, okay, wait a minute, I've got it, or at least I'll figure it out as I go along.
Yeah, you've got some breadcrumbs to follow
to
future films. I want to start with the Godfather series. Is this the godfather of successful sequels? It's influenced so many other movies.
Leave the gun. Take the cannoli.
Classic clip there. What do you think, T.T.?
Yes, yes, yes. I think this is, and again, you know, I'm sure, you know, attentive listeners have heard me talk about the fact that Blue Velvet is my favorite film. My second favorite film is all three of these films together.
Wow.
It really is. I know there are tons of people who think that the third film is the lesser of the three. That is not the case for me because I can't imagine just watching one of them at a time. I have to have them all together. In my head, they are one complete story.
Just all connected so closely.
Yes.
Well, and it seems to me that before The Godfather, the standard wisdom was the sequel's never as good as the original. And then that kind of turned that on its head, didn't it?
Yes, it did. I mean, if you think about, just again, conceptually, the second film is tracking two different stories at the exact same time. And you're seeing the rise of a young Vito Corleone as, you know, Robert De Niro, juxtaposed alongside the evolution of Michael Corleone. And in my head, I still do not like the idea that I have had to see De Niro and Pacino on the screen together at the same time. Because in my head, they still are just those two men, you know, a father and a son. And I can't escape the idea that that's how I feel that I should see them and appreciate them.
Yeah, just imprinted on your soul that way.
Yes.
Well, The Matrix, was this always envisioned as a trilogy? Was it only possible after the success of that first movie?
Mr. Anderson. You got my packet?
Yeah. Well, good.
That Mr. Anderson.
It gets me every time.
Yeah. Yes, yes. What do you think? Was this always, do you think these filmmakers always knew, hey, this is going to be a multi-parter?
I think the Wachowskis did know that. I don't think what we forget about these three films is the idea that that first film is revolutionary. You know, what happened as a result of that, which tends to overshadow the next two films, is we got bullet time out of that. And all of a sudden, this was, you know, technology and effects that we were seeing in films for the next 5 to 10 years. And everyone wanted to try to do it, put their own spin on it. And we forget that, again, what was really going on was they had a real philosophical kind of notion of how they wanted to conceive of the One. And I think I wrote about this in the piece. The idea of the One for me is so fascinating because it's really a love story. Except in this case, the savior, if you will, is not concerned about all of humanity. He falls in love with one person, and he wants to save that one person. Yeah. And because he can't save her, he then understands he has to save everybody else.
And you mentioned that that's really that piece of the story is something that unfolds over all three of those movies. It's not clear from the first one, for sure.
Not at all. And again, there's so much power in that, that you, if you really delve into it in that way, it takes you, it's a great way to get away from bullet time effects and the fight sequences, which are all amazing. They're fun to watch, but there was something deeper going on in this story the entire time.
Yeah. Well, I want to remind our listeners, we're talking with film critic T.T. Stern-Enzi about some of his favorite film trilogies and what makes a trilogy great. Let's talk about The Bourne Identity. That's another movie that is kind of this action movie in that genre that becomes a love story. Right. Talk with us about that, and how important is that to the success of a great trilogy, do you think?
I'm a huge fan of the idea of the romantic arc. I have written about this for the last 25 years. Just, you know, it's such a simple thing. Boy meets girl, boy loses girl, boy gets girl back. But to think that you could tell a story in three films where you break it down and each of those pieces is its own complete story, but you're still looking at, again, in this case, the first film, he meets this woman. She becomes basically his accomplice in what's going on. He doesn't understand or know who he is. She helps him figure this out. He falls in love with her. He loses her. In the second film, spoiler alert, she gets killed.
The ultimate loss.
The ultimate loss. So he has to avenge her. That's what he does in that second film. And in the third film, he doesn't get her back, but he gets a replacement for her who is just as important to him as she was. And again, great action films. We don't have the Daniel Craig Bond films in the way that we have them without the Bourne series. So again, the impact of the series is there, but it's a great, great love story.
I want to ask you about Three Colors. I'm going to confess I haven't seen these movies. Tell us about what these movies are all about, and then kind of make the case for why someone should invest the time to watch one or all of these movies.
I think the easiest way to do this, and I'm a huge fan of all these films, Kieslowski was one of those directors who loved this kind of philosophical notion of tying multiple stories together. He did a 10-part series called The Decalogue that was based on the Ten Commandments.
Wow.
Each story, a different commandment. So he was always thinking about these things, but in this case, he looked at the French flag, the colors and the symbol and the meaning behind, you know, the themes of that flag. Blue, which is the first film, is easily my favorite because the music is just otherworldly. And it is about a composer who ends up dying with his daughter in an accident. And his wife, who is also a composer, decides on her own, after much soul searching, that she wants to complete the project that he was working on. And you hear these snippets of the music that are playing throughout the story, and it is powerful and beautiful. And yes, it is, again, it's just amazing. But again, he's done this with three separate stories. You're looking at, you know, liberty and fraternity and all of these deep and really interesting, meaningful things. He's telling three separate stories, but by the end, you start to see, and he finds a way to connect them all together. And to know that there was a plan behind that, again, from the start, is what's so fascinating about it.
Yeah. This doesn't sound like their typical happy ending Hollywood movies, though.
Not exactly. I mean, they're the second one, White, is very funny in lots of really bizarre and almost surreal ways. So there's humor there. There's obviously romance. But it's a tougher sit. But again, I guarantee you, if you spend the time with it, you will be moved.
You will be rewarded. Okay, one of the many, many iterations of Batman made your list. I want to ask you what sets these Batman movies apart for you compared with all the others. I mean, the cast is certainly amazing.
This city just showed you that it's full of people ready to believe in good.
I have to say, that voice gets me a little bit. That,
you know. I know what you mean. It does me too.
Yeah, I think he had bronchitis throughout the filming of every one of these movies. That's the only explanation for that choice. But
yes, that's the one problem that I have with all of these films. But everything else really works. And again, it's the idea that you knew really from start to finish. Christopher Nolan wanted to tell three separate stories. He gave you sort of, again, the origin is not just the origin story of Bruce Wayne and Batman. It's the origin of Gotham City. He's showing us the corruption and the things that are going on in this space and why it is so dark and disturbing. And then we get to see this hero kind of become the thing and the person that that city needs. Not that they necessarily want, which we get into. There's a line about that in the film, but this is he's the hero that they need, and they desperately need a hero. And by the time we see him in the third film, he's come to recognize that, you know, he is so entwined with that city, but maybe there's a way for both of them to be free of each other. But it's going to take a lot to get there. And it is dark and brooding and full of these really complicated characters. You know, unfortunately, we lost Heath Ledger, probably one of the strongest villainous performances that we're ever going to see outside of maybe Alan Rickman in Die Hard. You know, it's that kind of performance. Sets that world and the stage and the characters. He gives it all to us. No other Batman, no other even singular Batman film has done what these three films did.
Yeah.
For that whole mythos.
Well, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, but I seem to remember when Heath Ledger got that role as Joker, there was a lot of, holy moly, Jack Nicholson played Joker in another iteration of Batman. How do you compete with Jack Nicholson? But he kind of ate his lunch, didn't he?
He really did. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Joker, if we think about it, you know, the Batman story has been told millions of times. You had Cesar Romero, who did it on the TV series back in the day.
That cheeky Joker.
Yeah. But I loved his Joker,
oh,
too.
My gosh,
like,
yeah.
There's something to love about every iteration of this character. But somehow, and Joaquin Phoenix will probably disagree with me about this completely, but I still believe that Heath Ledger gave us something in there that we are never going to see again. Mm. Yeah. He took it to a completely different level. Every time I watch that film and I see him go through and he'll ask someone, "Do you want to know how I got these scars?"
Oh, my gosh.
And he's telling a different story every time, but yet you almost want to believe that they're all true.
Mm-hmm.
They're either all true or none of them are true, but you want to believe that they're all true.
Yeah, yeah, it really is amazing. It gave me chills when you talked about that line in the movie. It really is something to watch. Okay, you have Back to the Future on your list. It's been decades since I have seen these films. I want to talk about what explains its staying power.
Marty, you've got to come back with me.
Where?
Back to the future.
Gotta love hearing that Christopher Lloyd voice. And what do you think explains the staying power of Back to the Future?
It is just pure, innocent fun. It is, you know, the serialized kind of adventures that you would imagine from a much different time, an earlier age, with what was at the time very modern technology and the feel and all of that. It felt very immediate, but it also had that old school kind of pull that when I say old school now, I'm talking even older than what we think about with old school. And it is, yeah, we don't have that sense of innocence and fun in films as much anymore. And you had it in Michael J. Fox. And it's sad that we will. I mean, this is one of the few on this list that, as you look at them, some have had fourth or fifth films that have been made after. I would have loved to have seen another one of these, but we're not going to get that chance. but what we have is all you need.
Yeah.
It really is.
First time I ever saw a DeLorean, that's for sure. Seeing it on the screen, I mean, that car was just wacky.
Yes, the car is wacky. You know, again, Christopher Lloyd, you know, we all talk about Michael J. Fox, but I don't think that film works or that trilogy works at all without that crazy, spunky, fire brain kind of energy that he brings to it. And yeah, I'm always going to love those characters.
Well, and amazingly, our associate producer, Asiya Johnson, was reminding me that a lot of the stuff that the second film kind of predicted, it was supposed to be looking at 2015, we ended up having, like, video calls, not the hoverboards in the way we all would like. I mean, I'm still waiting for my hovercraft. I've been waiting for that since the Jetsons. I don't know what's going on with that technology. But how cool is that? Do you think that helps those films carry on, that they were right about things?
I think it does. And it's not even necessarily that they were completely right. Because, yes, there are lots of things that we didn't get. But the things that they did get right were weirdly surprising.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yes, you wanted the hover car, but what they did get right, you're still kind of like, wow, how did they figure that out?
Yeah.
So you can watch it, and I think, you know, generations from now will still be able to watch it and kind of wonder, how did they know?
Yeah.
How did they figure that out? Or did we kind of learn from that and adapt and figure it out and make it? Because we looked at it and thought, that seems really cool.
Yeah. Got to have that. Well, Before Sunrise, that's another one on your list. And this is a trilogy that was made over nearly 20 years. How unusual is that, to have these stories told in practically in real time?
Right. Yeah. You know, obviously we know with Linklater, he's actually gone on and given us a film that he literally made in real time over the course of a decade or more. So His mind has always been wired in this way, but I think the more interesting part about these three films and the romantic element of them is the fact that he did the first film with another screenwriter, saw this connection that he got out of Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke, and they knew their characters so well that by the time they do the next two, they become the screenwriters. He's willing to incorporate and work them into this because he's like, you guys know these characters, even though in theory we're talking about them, you know, 9-10 years apart each time we see them in the different iterations. He's like, I trust that you're gonna remember, because these characters are part of you in a way. You'll be able to guide us through what the next phases of their lives are going to look like. And I just had a conversation about this with a film critic buddy of mine in LA this weekend. And we both talked about this because this trilogy is the one that, as moviegoers, we probably want to be these characters. Mm. Because they are so real and so vital and so interesting. And they're just talking. It's people talking and engaging with one another. And that's, out of all of these films on the list, this is the one that feels the most personal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think the involvement that those lead actors had in the screenplays for number two and number three, do you think that added to the authenticity and just the enjoyment people get out of watching those movies?
Yeah. I think it was a big part of that, because, again, we liked these people. And like I said, they understood them too. But we're not also talking about, people who dress up as bats or, you know, or living in an alternative world that is different from virtual reality versus real reality. These are just regular people. So they look and they feel like us in some way. They are struggling with the same issues of loving someone and being separated and having to rediscover a love years later. How would you handle that? We look at these stories and we think, yeah, that's how I would imagine it if I could go back and meet this person that I remember from 12 years ago that I had a fleeting moment with that I thought, maybe they could be the one. And they did that. They gave us that. They gave us a blueprint for what that could look like.
Yeah.
And maybe they've inspired a few people to go out and try to figure that stuff out for themselves in their own real lives.
There you go. Well, you have the Creed films on your list. What do you think makes that such a winning trilogy? And do you think there are other Rocky characters that could be explored in the same way?
You know, the other characters part of that question is going to be interesting because I think they're probably going to go in that direction. But what I love about this is, you know, they found just the right character. Because if you watch the Rocky films leading up to this, we always think about Stallone. But the problem with the next person we think of is Apollo Creed, Carl Weathers, who dies. And oddly enough, because he's actually, as a performer, still alive, it's weird that we lost him at a moment when you would think that if they had figured out a way to keep him alive, he and Rocky would have continued their friendship. And it would have, they'd still be going strong right now. So since we couldn't have that, they gave us the next best thing.
Yeah.
They gave us his son, who gets to bond with Rocky and then start to figure out his own life. And we get to watch his journey. And what'll happen is now he's going to get paired up with someone else. And it will spin and continue to evolve from there. And there's something really beautiful about that idea because, you know, having a protagonist who's so strong and so powerful tends to overshadow everyone else. But in the Rocky series, as huge a figure as he is, he really doesn't necessarily overshadow everyone.
Yeah.
All of those supporting players, they all have their moments. They all feel very vital to us as well. So this is a great way for that to live on.
Yeah. Well, you've got so many more movies on your list. I encourage everyone to check out your column on WVXU.org. I'm going to say I'm assuming that the only reason Toy Story isn't on there is because they made a fourth one. So I'm just going to hold that in my heart. I've been talking with film critic T.T. Stern Enzi. You can read his full column on our website, WVXU.org. Thank you so much for your time today, T.T.
Thank you. This was always fabulous.
It was great. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. Rob Fetters composed our theme music. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.